streaming live tonight on Twitter, Facebook, and YouTube. For more episodes of The Nick Holt Show, visit nickholt.substack.com and subscribe. A reminder that I'm running a special offer until the end of July on yearly subscriptions. My guest tonight is former LNP and One Nation member George Christensen. George retired from politics in May of this year after Scott Morrison and the LNP totally humiliated themselves in a fairly predictable election defeat to Labor. George is now plying his original trade of journalism through the Nation First Substack page, which you can find at nationfirst.substack.com. His podcast, Conservative One, can be found on all the major podcast networks. Now, in case you are unaware of this, George was one of a handful of LNP members who had the backbone and the clarity of conscience to cross the floor of the upper house and reject the abhorrent mandates forced on you and Australian citizens during COVID-19. Why they did this to the Australian people, I don't know exactly. One can certainly speculate. It's becoming apparent to many, though, that the puppets in the Australian government are simply that, puppets. Most of the pain inflicted on Australians, however, was done so by global governing bodies, one in particular called the World Economic Forum, an organisation that is perhaps the true architect of COVID-19. Before I bring George in to talk about this, because he's written quite extensively on the topic of this, and he's done more research than a lot of people, I want to read the introduction from a book, which is a very crucial book, perhaps the most crucial book. And it reads like a technocratic fascist manifesto. It's titled COVID-19, The Great Reset. And it was written by the chairman of the World Economic Forum, Klaus Schwab. I'll read that now. Since it made its entry onto the world stage, COVID-19 has dramatically torn up the existing script of how to govern countries, live with others, and take part in the global economy. COVID-19, the Great Reset, considers its far-reaching and dramatic implications on tomorrow's world. The book's main objective is to help understand what's coming in a multitude of domains. Published in July 2020 in the midst of the crisis and when further waves of infection may still rise, it is a hybrid between a contemporary essay and an academic snapshot of a crucial moment in history. It includes theory and practical examples, but is chiefly explanatory, containing many conjectures and ideas about what the post-pandemic world might and perhaps should look like. The book has three main chapters, offering a panoramic overview of the future landscape. The first assesses what the impact of the pandemic will be on five key macro categories. They are the economic, societal, geopolitical, environmental, and technological factors. The second considers the effects in micro terms on specific industries and companies. And the third hypothesizes about the nature of the possible consequences at the individual level. In early July 2020, we are at a crossroads. The author of COVID-19, The Great Reset, argued, one path will take us to a better world, more inclusive, more equitable, and more respectful of Mother Nature. The other will take us to a world that resembles the one we just left behind, but worse and constantly dogged by nasty surprises. We must therefore get it right. The looming challenges could be more consequential than we have now, until now, chosen to imagine. But our capacity to reset could also be greater than we previously dared hope. George Christensen, thanks for coming back on the program.
Well, thanks very much, Nick. It's good to be back with you.
Now, that sounds to me like really a carbon copy of the utopian idealistic socialism that's come before before this, but it's perhaps a bit more nefarious than that, isn't it?
Well, I think it is. If you have a look at the World Economic Forum and what they're trying to do, I mean, they talk about, obviously, the topic that you want to talk about today, the Great Reset, and it's a reset of capitalism. But the resetting of capitalism makes it look less like what you and I would envisage a true market economy to be, a market economy of free enterprise, one that is more dictated by governments and by big corporations. And that is not free enterprise. But it's that's just the economics. We could get more into the social side of it, but that's just the economics.
Let's maybe start just sort of by setting the table here and giving people a better understanding, and probably me too, of who exactly the World Economic Forum is.
Yeah, so the World Economic Forum, if people haven't heard of it, they've obviously been hiding under a rock, but it is a globalist think tank. It's based itself in Davos in Sweden. It's a little place that's on the border of Sweden and Belgium. And basically, it organises the annual Davos summit where the big, the powerful, the rich, and the famous all get together for a conference. And there's headline speakers at this conference. Some of them are names that you might be familiar with, Bill Gates, George Soros. And what they do is they try and set a policy agenda for that particular year. So they make no bones about this. This is not conspiracy talk. This is a large organization getting together all of the people that have their hands on the levers of power, whether that's through finance, whether that's through corporations, whether that's through politics, whether that's through media and entertainment. And they basically then educate them on what the World Economic Forum thinks is the kind of decisions that need to be made, is the kind of future that we need to live. So that is basically it in a nutshell. That's what the World Economic Forum is.
One thing that is particularly frustrating, to use a sort of a euphemism, is that these policy agendas are set without any consultation with the Australian people. And this actually, in my opinion, creates an environment where it can be called a conspiracy theory. Mm-hmm. When you were a member, when you were in the LNP, were you made aware of any of this stuff?
Look, I guess that I had heard about the World Economic Forum before, but really it largely came to the forefront of my attention and, I guess, public imagination over the course of the last 2 years. But it has been, this is an organisation that's been going, I think, since the 70s, if I'm not mistaken.
1971,
Klaus Schwab has been running this outfit for quite some time. And but they have got their fingers into a lot of different pies. If you have a look on the World Economic Forum website, you can look up the partners, and it is seriously, I mean, it's done in alphabetical order. And you see the names of the organisations just listed under A, and it is a collection of the largest corporations and non-profits on the planet. And if you go on there would not be a single major corporation or perhaps even a major not-for-profit organisation that wouldn't belong to this outfit. So they've been around, they've been doing their work for quite some time. But as I said, the last couple of years really come to the forefront. And I think that's because Klaus Schwab, who, as you've outlined, is the head of this outfit, the chairman and founder of the World Economic Forum, he wrote that book that you read from, COVID-19, The Great Reset. And what he said was that COVID-19 and the pandemic itself provided this great opportunity. You know, while others were worried about the potential for death, Klaus Schwab and the globalist elites that are part of the World Economic Forum were looking at it as an opportunity to actually reset the world's economic, social, and political agenda. And, you know, as I've alluded to, they talk about making it, turning the economy from a model of capitalism as it is now, which is not perfect. I completely and utterly acknowledge that, that it does need to be changed. But they're basically saying we need to redefine capitalism, turn it into this thing, so-called shareholder capitalism. But when you scratch the surface beyond it, it's not shareholder capitalism. You know, of all of the sort of the advertising copy and spin that they've put up on their website about what they want to do, ultimately what they want to do with the economy is to change it from the free enterprise model to a complete crony corporatist hybrid Marxist model, which they call stakeholder capitalism. And that might just sound really bizarre to say, you know, a corporate model combined with a Marxist model or a socialist model. But mate, it's been done before. I mean, the Nazis called themselves National Socialists and they deployed the major corporations in Germany to do their bidding. The same thing happened in Italy. We had a name for that. It was called fascism. So, and people might think, oh, you've gone too far, just sort of jumping into Nazi Germany and fascist Italy. Well, I don't think that the future is going to be like Nazi Germany, right? But yeah, it's going to be one of technocracy. And that book and other books that that Klaus Schwab has put out are basically the manual or manuals for how to establish technocratic systems across the planet. And that's what they want. We don't decide what's for us. Our betters will decide, and our betters are going to be the technocrats.
Yeah, if you can, talk a little bit more about stakeholder capitalism.
Yeah, so this is straight from the WEF website. They say all companies should still seek to harness their core competencies. I mean, by the way, this is the advertising copy, right? It's they're not going to say anything here that's nasty or untoward. But I'll just read you what they say. So all companies should still seek to harness their core competencies and maintain an entrepreneurial mindset, but they should also work with other stakeholders to improve the state of the world in which they are operating. In fact, this latter proviso should be their ultimate purpose. I'll just pause there. I mean, who are these stakeholders? Improve the state of the world, we'll get 10 people in the room to tell them to improve the state of the room they're in, and you get 10 different views. Improving the state of the world, whose improvements and to improve it for whom? That's what I want to ask. But I'll go on. They say by giving stakeholder capitalism concrete meaning, they can move beyond their legal obligations and uphold their duty to society. They can bring the world closer to achieving shared goals, such as those outlined in the Paris Climate Agreement, so there's that hoary old chestnut, and the United Nations Sustainable Development Agenda. Now, that is part of Agenda 21, part of Agenda 2030 now. So let's just park that for a second, but there you go. The Paris Agreement and Agenda 2030 are part of this. If they really want to leave their mark on the world, there is no alternative. Now, that's an important endpoint that the WEF said. They want these corporations to leave their mark on the world. And I got to tell you, do you really think that they're going to be, I mean, when you look at this list, this Rolodex full of, on the WEF website, full of the biggest corporations on planet Earth, do you really think, given these are the people who are behind the World Economic Forum, that they are going to put aside the profit motive and do what's best for all of humanity? Or do you think that their definition of stakeholder capitalism is something different altogether? So the question that I ask is, as I said, Who decides what an improved state of the world would look like? We've got wealthy, powerful people from politics, business, and from non-government organisations. I name dropped a few of them, Klaus Schwab, George Soros, but mate, the chairman of the International Business Council, the CEO of probably every major bank in the world, the head of the International Monetary Fund, Prince Charles, he's really in touch with the common man, Al Gore, Greta Thunberg. There is a myriad of people who are involved with this outfit who have views on the state of the world, and they would not align with the views of the average person in the street in Australia or America or Great Britain for that matter. And so if their views don't align, how is their view around improving the state of the world going to align? The improvements will be for the big end of town. The improvements will be for major corporations. The improvements will be for politicians and governments and technocrats within both government and corporations. That is the future that they are wanting.
That's right. And we see this in this document as well, in the COVID-19 Great Reset. It's a disturbing document. It's a very dark, I would say it's a very godless, dark, inhumane document of a kind of cold, mechanistic approach to human beings, right? We just slot into little categories. And yep. in this document, as you probably know, there's a section on, I'm just trying to find it again. Basically, they're giving advice on morality. These people, right?
Yeah.
That's kind of like they're the last people that objectively you would consider to approach them for advice on morality. But
well,
the top down. Yeah, go ahead.
Again, you're talking about morality and how to treat people better. A lot of people are listening to some of Russell Brand's great YouTube videos and Rumble videos that he's been doing. And Russell got hold of some information that he put out there publicly. Apparently one of the employees, one of the lower level, actually it wasn't a lower level employee, it was a middle level employee of the World Economic Forum, had the temerity to park in Klaus Schwab's parking spot while Klaus Schwab was on holidays. And Schwab wasn't using the parking spot, and this person decided that they would because it was closer. And Klaus Schwab demanded that that person be fired as a result. And, so much for morality and ethics and doing what's right by your fellow man. That sort of speaks volumes about the kind of person that Klaus Schwab is. Who how dare you park in my parking spot? And again, it just gives cause for concern about the agenda that an organization headed up by a guy like that is trying to push on the world. And they are pushing it on the world. You asked me before and I didn't properly answer it. I'm sorry. I'm still stuck in that politician phase. You asked me the question about, what had I seen from the WEF in Australia. Like, I know there's WEF agendas that are actually finding their way into the Australian legislative process. That is without a doubt. There are people actually in our parliament who are aligned with the WEF through various different means. So one example that I can give you, and I'm happy to talk about this later during this discussion, but the digital identity agenda. I mean, this was legislation that, God forbid, a conservative party, ostensibly as a liberal or national party should be, devised that would be the biggest invasion of our privacy that any government in Australian history has ever tried to actually undertake. And they pulled together this legislation. Now, this just didn't come out of the ether. Normally laws come about, good laws anyway, because people have actually asked for a problem to be fixed or for something to be changed. But no one has ever stopped me in the street, emailed me, phoned me, requested a meeting with me, or said anything to me ever about wanting a digital identity. I've never had that experience where someone has stopped me in the middle of the shopping centre as a member of parliament and said, George, you know what? I wake up in the morning and I get really, 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 really terribly frightened because I don't have a digital identity. No one said that ever, ever. And so where did it come from? Because in democracy, this sort of stuff's supposed to come from the ground up. But I tell you who is pushing for a worldwide digital identity agenda. That is the World Economic Forum. And
yes.
And so that's just one thing. And I will finish my rant on this. It's interesting how things swiftly changed during the last 2 years. So when this topic of the Great Reset was being proposed, it was the sort of catch cry being put out there. We need to reset things. We need to do, along with the term build back better, of course, that was also thrown about.
I've been saying that around much lately.
Yeah, that's attached to this Great Reset agenda. It's a, sort of one of the slogans for it, if you will. But Scott Morrison, who was the then Prime Minister of Australia, got on some telelink to a WEF forum. It was perhaps the one, the Davos one that they had online. And he said, we don't need a reset. We just need to get on with it. And I thought, wow. Way to go, Scotty. He's standing up to these globalists. That's that, you don't say that. And he said that to them, to their face, that we don't need a reset. So it was like, okay, Scott Morrison's sort of, drawn a line in the sand. We're not going to have this crap here in Australia. And then the next thing, Scott Morrison's attending the Davos summit either online or in person, I forget, but he's attending a Davos summit and telling him, we're adopting the WEF's digital identity agenda. We're pushing ahead with it in Australia. So what happened on the road to the Colosseum? What happened? I don't know, but their power grew, their status grew, and someone who was the head of the government here basically went from telling them, get stuffed, we're not going to have your reset agenda, to telling them, oh, we're being good little boys and girls, we're implementing what you want here in Australia. That's weird.
It was very bizarre. As Klaus Schwab has said, they've managed to, quote unquote, penetrate cabinets, right?
Yeah.
And it's just so disappointing that these people end up becoming, so powerful in such a bad way. Because if you take a look at Klaus Schwab, I mean, you'd flush his head down the toilet and steal his lunch money, right?
Well, he probably has
Bill Gates. That's right. They've always got their goons. They've got their goons. But this document, I mean, I can't believe that Australian journalists or whatever, other journalists, are not covering this story. It's, and I would have to assume that they're obviously either they don't know, they're not allowed to, or they're fine with it. This is if you pitch this Great Reset and Fourth Industrial Revolution, they're pitching it like a technological revolution, and a couple of things Schwab says in there is not actually untrue. One thing he talks about, the three things of interconnectedness, velocity. How about their buzzwords? It's ridiculous. Yeah. Interconnectedness, velocity, and then there's one more. But in velocity, he's talking about the speed now at which the world operates, and not just the celerity at which goods are shipped around the world and stuff, but the demand for wanting something right now.
Yep.
And he identifies this as a problem, and I agree with him, right? But
the
answer is not this solution. Yeah.
So you hit the nail on the head. There's a lot of, look, you know, I spoke some months back with Professor Matthias Desmet, who is just written a book called The Psychology of Totalitarianism. Great book, by the way. You should go and read it. But we got around to talking about the World Economic Forum because he was the one that's come up with this theory, or an observation, I should say, that the world has suffered from a mass formation event over the past 2 years because of COVID. I think he's spot on with that assumption, but he talked about organizations that push certain agendas that are allowed to go forward. And one of them was the World Economic Forum. And he said they can do this because people want to change from what's been before. So it's not just the fact that we've been through this pandemic. It's that there's been a high level of what Desmet calls floating anxiety about for quite some time. You know, people have got shit jobs. The 1% are getting wealthier and wealthier every day. We've got, you know, poverty, homelessness, family breakdown, drugs, you know, all of this stuff compounding. And people like, you know what? Well, we do want to change. We want something different than what's being offered now. And I agree with that. But the agenda that's going to be driven by these folks, who are the 1%, they're not the 1%, they're the 0.0001%. They are the people who actually right now already are making the decisions that are impacting our lives. They're the people who have been in power over the past,
yes,
goodness knows how many decades, that has caused this free-floating anxiety and all of these social ills and economic ills that I've spoken about. And these are the people we're going to put our trust in to reset the world, to make it a better place. Well, I don't think they're going to make it a better place. They're going to make it a worse place. And you talked about something that is so important. And I remember speaking with Corey Bernardi on Sky News about the Great Reset some time ago. And when I started talking about this particular aspect that I'm about to, he couldn't believe me. He shut the conversation down a bit because he thought this is crazy stuff. But they literally have an agenda to push transhumanism. What's transhumanism? Well, it's the fusion of mankind with robots and computers. And if you think, oh, well, we're talking about bionic arms or bionic legs, now that's great, but they're not talking about that. They're talking about the ultimate fusion of humanity and technology. They're talking about, you know, doing stuff with your brain. They are talking about something that will ultimately change mankind completely and not for the better.
Yeah.
And when I say change, you would not be human as we currently know it. You would be human plus robot plus computer. It's weird, but they are not just out there talking about it. They're out there encouraging it with research, pushing this through companies. This is an agenda we are going to see more and more of in the future.
Yeah, and it's a very nasty symptom in terms of the human condition of these kinds of people rejecting God. Now, I know there's some people watching this who don't believe in God, and that's fine. That's fine. I don't have a problem with any of that. Everyone has a right to kind of believe what they would like to believe. But when you have these particular people that don't just reject God, they believe that they can actually become God by doing this sort of thing. And this dates back, this is not conspiracy. This goes back to Ray Kurzweil with the singularity theory, right? The merging of man and machine. But I just want to take it back a sec to mass formation to talk briefly about that. I come from a slightly different school of thought to Matthias. I don't reject his theory at all, but where I sort of differ here from perhaps you two is I think that the free-floating anxiety may not be connected to these external things that, that you mentioned, because if we take a look at history, we are actually, capitalism, you mentioned at the start of the show, lifted many, many millions, if billions of people out of poverty. We have everything at our fingertips, right? That's what I think causes the free-floating anxiety, is the machines that we've been integrated to start using. It's already happened. It doesn't have to be inside your brain, right? There's a reason why the show, you know, they call this the Black Mirror. And I don't know if you've seen Sandra Bullock's movie Bird Box, I think it was called. Yeah. So this is a film. You have seen that?
I know of it. I haven't seen it.
So the film, very quickly, the synopsis of it is that people see something and just the sight of what they've seen causes them to commit suicide instantly. And then the whole movie is a sort of film. It was full on. It was the whole movie then is the protagonist, Sandra Bullock, trying to get to a location where they're protected, but the birds can sense this. And it's inside this kind of, almost Garden of Eden type thing. But the idea that some of the theories behind what it was they were seeing was social media or the internet. I don't think we perhaps place enough gravity on how serious just how serious social media and the internet is in the scheme of our time frame of being human beings. It came on very quickly, very hard. So with that, I'm not too sure about that free-floating anxiety being attached to things like poverty, because I think if you went to an African village, they probably don't have enough time, to be thinking about free-floating anxiety, because they're trying to get food or they're trying to do this or that. But what is correct is that COVID-19, I saw this unfold as it was happening. When those videos came out with Wuhan, I noticed that there was the same reaction to those videos as there was to George Floyd, school shootings, to name two, and Brenton Tarrant. People slip in. It's such an intense attack on the emotions and the senses of humans that it does put them into this position of, for lack of a better term, psychosis, where they're drawn into just seeing the one thing, as Matthias says, sort of like the hypnotists doing that, right? So as people in Australia were perhaps surprising to maybe a lot of us that it was easier for Australians to fall into that state. What are your thoughts on that?
Yeah, look, I think that you're right. Social media has fundamentally changed the way we engage with each other. Twitter being the worst of the worst. And so there's a great piece by Jordan Peterson the other day, a speech that he gave about how Twitter is insane. And the problem is it's making a lot of other people insane by just wanting to have everything degenerated to a short, pithy insult or a snappy line. Well, that's not appropriate discourse. So I think that it's caused a problem for society, that's for sure. But the latter part, could you just recap on the latter part of your talking about the footage? Just recap on that.
Yeah, sure. I just think that seeing the footage that scared me.
So we're smaller. So that's what I thought you were saying. So the world is smaller because of mass communications. Yeah. And so you're right in a way that, I still would maintain that a lot of the problems are what's triggering the free-floating anxiety, but it's also awareness of a lot of those problems, right? Before people lived in blissful ignorance in a way. And I would also say that it is something very much of a Western, it's a Western thing. You know, we call them first world problems. You're right, when you're in a nation that actually has complete and utter abject poverty, not relative poverty, but abject poverty, where the vast bulk of people are making a subsistence living or are below that, then you really don't have time to navel gaze. You're just doing what you can to survive. And I actually seen this in third world countries. It's not just doing what you can to survive. Some people are actually happy and content. This, as I was in this car coming out of the slum, that I'd been taken to visit an educational facility, the charity that was taking me there pointed out all of these ramshackle little tin huts on the side of the road. And as I'm looking at them, and they're telling me people live in there, that's their home, I'm watching these kids who have, through the garbage that's around them, fashioned together a makeshift tight, you know, with bits of used plastic and sticks and a piece of string, and are running along as happy as that they had this kite there. Now, you know, so that's one thing. But in the West, we are not used to that. We have had, obviously, a lot of prosperity, particularly in recent times, which may be grinding to a sudden halt actually now. But that prosperity has sort of, it's made us a bit soft. What's the old saying? Strong
hard
men.
Times.
Now we've got hard times. We've got good times, and that's produced weak men, and those weak men have produced hard times.
Yeah,
and
definitely.
There's some truth in that. And I think that that's all leading up to what I'm talking about. But to get back to the World Economic Forum and the Great Reset, these hard times that we are now going to find ourselves in, my view, and I think there is a great deal of evidence behind this view, is that largely these hard times have been manufactured. Now, does that mean that someone's deliberately gone out and created a worldwide food shortage? Well, I'm not necessarily saying that, and I want to be very specific with my words. I'm not necessarily
keep an eye out for news.com tomorrow. It'll be front. It'll be the latest.
Well, mate, could there have been an effort to do that that was deliberate? I don't know. I'm not invited to the meetings. But of course
there could.
Are there things that have happened that have policies that have been implemented that Blind Freddy could have seen would exacerbate a food crisis, would cause a food crisis? Yes.
Yeah, that
is absolutely. These are why the farmers are protesting over in Holland right now. These are why Sri Lanka is just undergone a revolution, because there have been policies put in place that have harmed the producers of food, and policies that people knew must have harmed the production of food. And so now there's revolution in countries as a result of this. And the same can be said for the inflation, the stagflation and inflation that we're experiencing and we're going to continue experiencing. People have been saying, or for a long time now, do not keep on printing money. Do not keep on throwing out free money. Do not keep on doing it, because you are going to cheapen the value of the dollar.
Yeah.
And at that stage, prices will rise and you end up in this madness, this mad cycle, where you're circulating more money to deal with the rising inflation, and the circulation of more money is causing the inflation, and you never get out of it. And where you end up is destination Zimbabwe, where people were using, the largest denomination notes to basically wallpaper their homes to burn, to keep warm, because that's all it was good for.
And interestingly, on the topic of mass formation, there was a book, the idea of mass formation actually comes from a book that is prescribed reading in economics degrees, and it's called Popular Delusions and the Madness of Crowds, written by a guy called
Charles Murray.
Yeah, you know.
Right.
No, Charles Mackay.
Charles Mackay, sorry, yes, you're right.
Charles Murray wrote The Bell Curve.
Yes, that's right, yeah.
Yeah, and he talks in that about, in that book there are a number of examples of when societies have gone into these delusions, right, because they thought that there was going to be some sort of economic gain. So like the Louisiana shipping trade in France, where stock tickets were, they started printing money and devaluing the silver. And people just went nuts because they all thought they were going to get rich. And, you know, in a way, that's happened to Australians, because whether or not we had COVID, we weren't on a trajectory of sort of any kind of fiscal conservatism that would make for a well-balanced economic society, or at least an economy. And then within that economy, there's the culture of economy, which is how people spend and what they do. And we've been, you know, we've been living in a kind of a familiar scenario to previous empires when they were close to the edge of collapse. And that is usually, it's usually sort of noted by large welfare states. Just keep pumping out cash. What do you want? Yeah, that's fine. We'll do that. We'll give you that. So part of me is a bit concerned that now COVID has, you know, you add in COVID to that, George, and you really do have Klaus Schwab's idea here. And it's very difficult to believe. You asked, has this been manufactured? Well, I mean, look, I don't know, obviously, but it's very difficult to believe that COVID-19, the Great Reset, that book was knocked up in response to the pandemic. This has been planned for a long time.
Oh, yes. And again, you know, ultimately, well, I can't say ultimately it matters not. Obviously, it would matter. The result, though, is going to end up the same unless someone stands up to the agenda. You know, they, you know, you never let a good crisis go to waste. That's an age-old saying in politics. And these people who have had these ideas for some time have certainly, at the very least, not let this crisis go to waste to push them. And they are being pushed. We spoke about Build Back Better. Now, it's become almost a meme or a popular video. So it is a terrible slogan, but it's a terrible slogan. It's been adopted by leaders the world over. Joe Biden, Build Back Better. You know, Boris Johnson, Build Back Better. They all come out.
Jacinta Ardern.
Justin Castro, Build Back Better. Jacinta Ardern, Build Back Better. Marcos Jr. Is just given his maiden speech, or what do you call it, inauguration speech, Build Back Better. He used the term. It's been fed to him by these globalists and elitists that are in the World Economic Forum. It is a catch cry to bring in the things that they reckon need to be reset. And a big part of it is going to be about the loss of freedoms and privacy to support what they see to be the greater good. ESG lies at the heart of this. If you haven't, a lot of your listeners will know what ESG is all about. It stands for environmental, social and governance. It's sort of this movement that's now become a thing within investments and within corporations. You have to show that you are good corporate citizens by showing what your environmental goals are, your social goals are, your governance goals, and meeting those goals, like as a complement to the financial metrics that you would otherwise have as a company. Well, Well, what that ultimately does is puts these major corporations into the role almost of governments, where they are taking actions that they believe are better for the environment, that they believe, or the World Economic Forum or someone else like that, believes are better for society, and they are imposing that on us. Now, how can that happen? Well, Glenn Beck, who runs Blaze News over in the US, he's been around a fair while. He's written a book, actually, on the Great Reset. It's a good read. But he's done a lot of deep diving into the ESG thing. And he's actually found evidence, and it's very early days yet, but he's found evidence that what banks in the US are most likely planning on doing with their customers is providing them ESG scores, particularly with emphasis on the E, environmental, because, again, you know, everything's got to be about the Paris Agreement, everything's got to be about sustainability. And so if you don't meet that score, or if you're doing something that the bank thinks is really not in line with our ESG goals, then they could ditch you or penalize you. Now, for instance, if you love, I don't know, do you love V8 cars, Nick?
A lot of Aussies love V8s. For the sake of this argument, yes.
Yes, okay. So
I like driving them.
My brother, right, he's in love with Monaros and Toranas. He's in love with them. He's gone out and bought old Monaros and Toranas and done them up and sold them. He owns one. He will keep on buying them until the day he is pushing up daisies. So he goes to his bank. He wants to buy a $100,000 classic Torana that he's found. He wants it. And he's good for it because he's got $200,000 plus year income, having worked his way up in the mining industry, right? The bank knocks him back. Why? Because it's a gas guzzler. Because actually now we only want our customers to be purchasing EVs, which just happen to be powered off coal at the moment anyway. But we want our customers to be doing the right thing by our environmental, social and governance goals. Now, how far is this going to go, Nick? Because it could affect your household. What's your energy consumption like? Oh, yeah. We want you to install batteries. We want you to do this before we give you a mortgage. And do you know that there actually is a credit card, that MasterCard, I think it is, has partnered up with already, that sets a daily limit for your climate spend? Now, they know this. They've worked it out. What the daily limit is for someone to do right, apparently, by the planet. And if you exceed it, or if you try to exceed it, you'll just be cut off. You won't be able to spend another dollar.
I can picture it right now, trying to call an ambulance.
Yeah.
Unfortunately, we cannot send an ambulance to your home. Your carbon footprint is too big.
But it's here and it's being done voluntarily now. But mark my words, the day will come when banks start imposing these sort of rules on their customers. And this is when I talk about the fusion or a hybrid model of big government and big business, which basically is what the Great Reset is all about. This is what I'm talking about. They're all working to one big technocratic agenda where they know what's best for us and planet Earth. We are just to do what we are told. Democracy will be a mirage. It will be there, but it will be a thin veneer over the top of technocratic rule by both government bureaucrats and corporate bureaucrats who know better than us plebs. That's what the Great Reset is all about.
Yeah, and that's not even that's a very very accurate paraphrasing too. That's not George Christensen mouthing off his theory. This is if you are not willing to engage with this idea, the Great Reset, then you're being lazy, and you kind of need to do yourself a favor and understand. And I'm not suggesting this is to the people that follow you and I think they're generally across it. I'm talking about the ones that are rejecting this, calling it conspiracy theories. But just for a minute, let me just come back to the idea of it, of the economics behind it. So this is a paragraph from the book. He says, in the post-pandemic era, according to current projections, the new economic, quote, normal, unquote, may be characterized by much lower growth than in the past decades. As the recovery begins, quarter-to-quarter GDP growth may look impressive because it will start from a very low basis, but it may take years before the overall size of most nations' economies return to their previous pandemic level. This is also due to the fact that the severity of the economic shock inflicted by the coronavirus will conflate with a long-term trend. Declining populations in many countries and aging demographics is destiny and a crucial driver of GDP growth. That's true. Under such conditions, when lower economic growth seems almost certain, many people will wonder whether obsessing about growth is even useful, concluding that it doesn't make sense to chase a target of ever higher GDP growth. I mean, what? You won't find that. That is very anti-capitalism, right?
Yeah, that's basically saying put aside any notion that you're going to keep on being prosperous and do something else. Well, you know, it's either we prosper or we perish or we go into poverty. There's no other option, you know, unless the other option is we're all going to be equal, no matter what we put in, no matter what our skills are, no matter what our incentives are, we're all going to be equal. And there's a word for that. It's called socialism. But they don't want socialism. I'm very clear on this. I mean, I'm against socialism. What they want is a hybrid model of socialism and corporatism. And look, I'm going to go out on another trajectory here, because this is another thing that is being pushed as part of the Great Reset World Economic Forum agenda. So as we have more and more AI doing manual functions that human workers once did, and that is only going to continue to grow, what we actually have is a growing class of people who now are either low skills or unskilled, and they are now unemployable. So that is going to continue to grow. What do we do with that cohort of people? Now, this is not my argument. I'm just putting forward what people in the World Economic Forum have put forward. Can I stop there though and just say I disagree profusely with the idea that we should have fully automated services and fully automated workers replace manual workers. Just because you can do something doesn't mean you should do it. And I tell you what, if these major corporations were acting with a consideration around society, they wouldn't push towards automation because they would understand the major issue that is going to cause for so many people. But where they want to go with this is put them on a universal basic income. And all of these threads start joining together when you get to this final point, right? The digital identity push, the digital income push, or the digital currency push. We haven't gotten into that, but that's coming out of the World Economic Forum as well. And then you have a universal basic income, which is provided to you by government. So you get your money, Nick, to go and sit and watch Netflix and eat cheesels on the couch. You'll get, you know, something equivalent to what we had in Australia during the pandemic, $750 a week, I guess. That might be the going rate, and life might seem good. But you know what? As someone who is more of a traditionalist conservative, I'm not going to say, oh, this is terrible because, you know, people should be out there bloody working and providing something to the national economy. No, no, no. It's the other way around, actually. You have stripped the meaning of life for a lot of people by just relegating them to welfare recipients that are permanently just going to stay at home and do very little. Do very little. They will not be connected to anything bigger than the Netflix service. And that is not an existence. That really isn't. So why would they be pushing this? Well, again, they don't put it in the advertising copy that they run up on the World Economic Forum website or anywhere else. But it doesn't take Einstein to see that having government issue the vast bulk of its populace with a universal basic income means that that government has got major control over its citizens. You will have to do things, or you will have to not do things, in order to receive your full universal basic income. Nick, I've seen a few of your tweets, and those tweets might mean that your universal basic income is reduced. It has penalty points attached to it, because you've been a disruptor to the social good. Can you not see how this is coming? I mean, it's there in existence in communist China already, but it's found its way outside of communist China. A province in Italy only a month or so, 2 months ago, I think it was, adopted a voluntary social credit system. Now, where is this going? There was a UK parliamentarian who came out with this bright idea, and now, being a politician myself, sometimes we say some silly things, but when you give a speech in Parliament, you've thought it through. You've thought it through, and you believe there could be some electoral appeal to this idea. This parliamentarian from the governing party, the Conservatives in the UK, got up in the Parliament and actually said that they needed to bring in a truth score to be assigned to citizens that were online. So the government providing you a label, Nick, and I'm not sure what label the Nick Holt Show, what score the Nick Holt Show would give, but under this model, they'd rate you out of 10, I presume, as to how truthful you are. Now, if that doesn't sound like something out of the Ministry of Truth that was in George Orwell's 1984, I don't know what does. But this is the new world we enter. This is the Great Reset. This is the World Economic Forum agenda.
Sorry, I'm back now. I'll just finish on, thanks for letting me know. I'll just finish on this, George. You can hear me now?
Yeah, I can.
Okay, good stuff.
I can hear you.
Not sure what happened there. I'll just finish on this. I think that, you know, just as you said, just because we have the technology and we can doesn't mean we should. But I think technology, I remember my dad said this to me years ago, and he said, if we could just use the internet for good, for people sharing ideas and understanding each other's differences, this was quite a while ago, you know. And this is coming from a man who is a mathematician, so he had the original internet when they had to, like, you know, punch it in and send it across and ping someone in a university over in the States or something. But he said, yeah, if we can use this to understand each other, then it can be a real force for good. And I said, don't get your hopes up. It'll be mostly used for pornography and people arguing with each other. I think I was right. But in a way, I think we are now kind of doing what he suggested, because the amount of people I see on Twitter and all over the place that are on to what's going on, you know, they're, a lot of them know a lot more about this than I do. I reckon it's derailed them. I think that Schwab, if you look at that document, it's just ridiculous, to be honest. I just don't think these clowns are going to be able to pull it off. So, you know, I just leave tonight with that little note of hope. And I'd like your take on that, a final word.
Look, I think you're right, Nick. You know, there is always hope. You know, we don't have to just simply succumb to this future, but it takes brave men and women calling it out, pushing through the insults like conspiracy theorist and anti-vaxxer and all the rest of the numbnuts phrases that you hear all the time from people that just don't do any critical thinking. It takes people speaking out about this, and that is happening more and more. I mentioned Russell Brand before. Never, I used to hate the guy, right? Never did I think that I'd be putting Russell Brand on my regular viewership or podcast listening. But, you know, you get people like him who are out there and they're pulling back the curtain, and we're seeing the man in control, and, you know, it's not as scary as we all thought his agenda is, but he isn't. And so while we still have, as a people, the ability to influence democracy, and I believe we still do, then we can make a change. But really, 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 I just got to say to you, to so many other people, everyone who is for freedom just needs to be in this fight. They need to be speaking up. They need to be educating others. They need to be talking about this, because without knowledge and without the word spread, we're just going to succumb to it. It'll be fait accompli. You may as well pack your bags now and accept that great reset future. It doesn't have to be that way, though.
No, and I think the scenes from around the world are showing us that people are certainly doing that. And, you know, I just add that it's important to pace yourself with this stuff, because it's not going to be over tomorrow.
Yeah, that's right. This is a long fight.
George Christensen, thank you very much for coming back on the program, and we'll catch up again soon, hopefully.
Thanks very much, Nick. Great to be on, as always.
Just a reminder, you can find George's work on nationfirst.substack.com, and his podcast is called Conservative One, available on all major podcast platforms. My podcast, The Nick Holt Show, is available on all the major platforms too, as well as nickholt.substack.com. Thank you for listening, and have a great night.